Hey friends, I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud. I'm the host of the new podcast, Commotion. If you don't know about us yet, well, we are your daily deep dive into the biggest stories coming out of the world of pop culture, art, and entertainment. And luckily, I'm not going to be doing it alone, okay? I'll be joined by some brilliant culture writers and thoughtful superfans. We're going to have hilarious hot takes. We're going to have vibrant debates. Consider this your invitation to join the group chat. Get in here and join us. Commotion, available weekdays on CBC Listen.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud. An Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama could become the first unionized Amazon facility in the U.S. Now, normally, a warehouse unionizing would not make international headlines, but in the U.S., the legal and political framework makes joining a union, especially at a giant corporation like Amazon, an arduous task. So in this episode, we dig into why the U.S. is such a hostile environment for union organizing and whether Joe Biden, who has vowed to be the most pro-union president ever, can reverse that decline. It's also our last episode of the season. I know. So for our last episode, we are returning to journalist and author Sarah Kendzior to talk about what is next for America. That will be later on in the show, but first, to talk about unions, I'm joined by Barry Edlin, a professor at McGill University who looks at U.S. labor relations. We reached him in Los Angeles. You're listening to Party in the USA. Let's get started. Barry, welcome to the show. I'm really happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Alamin. Really appreciate it.
Listen, I think we got to start by saying, you know, it's fair to say that most Canadians have not heard of Bessemer, Alabama. But this is a town of 27,000, and it has kind of turned into this center, this hot spot in a battle over unionization, because that's where a group of Amazon warehouse employees are publicly calling for a union. What is going on here? What is the story?
Yeah, so this is a fairly new warehouse that opened up just last year, so basically right when the pandemic was hitting. If you include the temporary workers and seasonals, it's about close to 6,000 workers, about 5,800. And this warehouse services much of Alabama and I believe Mississippi as well. So it's a key sort of node in their southern distribution network. And obviously, Amazon's a company that's been going gangbusters during the pandemic, and they've been expanding and opening. And it didn't take long for these workers to, you know, have some issues with the brutal pace of work that Amazon is known for. The words they use are being treated like robots, basically.
Daryl Richardson works for Amazon, gathering products to fulfill orders. He clocks in and out every day, hoping he doesn't get COVID-19. He says it's difficult to maintain social distancing on the job with thousands of other employees.
You don't want to go to work every day and feel unsafe and not knowing if you're going to get corona.
And so they basically started organizing. There's all these hoops we can talk about that is part of the story of, you know, the hoops required just to get to an election, which is sort of the step that you need in order to be recognized as a legal bargaining unit that is entitled to engage in collective bargaining with the employer. So Amazon obviously fought this every step of the way. One thing they got is that they were able to require the temporary and seasonal workers to be included in the group of workers who are voting, you know, with their idea being that these are sort of workers who are less likely to vote in favor of the union because they're just tempered. They're just sticking around for a while. Why are they going to stick their neck out for something like that? And then meanwhile, the campaign has been just this case study in everything that is wrong with U.S. labor law. The workers have been bombarded with multiple texts and emails daily from one-on-one meetings, management tailing them around. This is a group of workers that they have trouble even making time for their lunch breaks, and they're being taken off their job for hours at a time to attend these quote-unquote seminars where they are basically educated about the evils of joining a union.
I assume you're saying evils quote-unquote here. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Why it would not be in their best interest, according to Amazon, for them to join a union. And this is, of course, all legal under U.S. law, or even the stuff that's not legal, the punishments are so minimal that it basically pays for the employer to break the law.
All right, so I want to come back to that in just a minute. But first, I think we got to talk about what makes us different. Because, you know, it's not the first time we've heard about unionization efforts at Amazon. I remember that there was a pretty substantial union vote in 2014. But we're seeing a lot of media interest in this story. We're seeing politicians like Bernie Sanders show up to this.
Because what you are doing requires an enormous amount of courage. And what you're doing is not only for yourselves and your kids and your families. What you are doing is for workers all across this country.
What's going on here? Like, why is this the one that's attracting so much attention?
Yeah, so this is a convergence of many different threads, basically. So number one, it would be the first group of Amazon workers in the U.S. to unionize. So we have to recognize that in Europe, there are many countries where Amazon workers are unionized, but it would be the first in the U.S. That campaign in 2014 was a small group in Delaware, I believe, of sort of technical workers. This is the entire warehouse, the entire fulfillment center, what they're called. So it was almost 6,000 workers. So it'd be one of the larger bargaining units in any union election in the U.S. in recent years. What's also at play here is that this is a union campaign in the South of the U.S. And the South, of course, has this history of anti-unionism and sort of vicious attacks on union organizers and workers trying to join unions. But then even more particularly, if you want to zoom in on Bessemer, Bessemer and Alabama actually have this sort of now hidden history of unionization and worker organizing. Bessemer used to be the site of a major steel plant.
So there's a history of unions there.
There's a history. Yeah, so there's a history of unions. So there's this union, the mine, mill, and smelter workers, which is a radical left-led union that really fought for civil rights. It was an anti-racist union. So there's a through line there to that sort of past history of organizing. And then the final thread is that this is a overwhelmingly Black workforce. And the organizers in the warehouse have been linking up with Black Lives Matter. And so there's the continuity with the labor history, and then there's the sort of meshing with the ongoing Black Lives Matter movement and sort of expanding that to labor organizing. Mm. And so all of that is sort of making this a sort of poster child for union organizing and attracting all this, you know, attention nationwide and worldwide.
One thing that we are seeing in response to that attention is Amazon PR has been, how do I politely put this? They're absolutely spinning out of control. I mean, they're picking fights with Bernie Sanders on Twitter, with Elizabeth Warren on Twitter. In one tweet, they say to Elizabeth Warren, you know, this is extraordinary and revealing. One of the most powerful politicians in the U.S. just said she's going to break up an American company so that they can't criticize her anymore. Is Amazon really playing the free speech angle? What are they trying to accomplish out of coming out so intensely against this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it's not just Amazon, right? So Amazon is just the company in the news right now, but almost any time a company is faced in the United States with the unionization campaign, there's a playbook. There are law firms and consulting firms that charge tens of thousands of dollars a day to advise these companies, and they all play from the same playbook, and Amazon is doing exactly the same thing, maybe with a bit more hyperbole on Twitter. Mm. So that aggressiveness is not just about Amazon. It's part of the employer response to unionization in the U.S. more generally. Now, Amazon really does seem to be sort of spinning off the rails, at least in terms of their PR people on Twitter. And I think it's indicative of the degree to which they are really freaked out about this campaign, mm-hmm. you know, because the thing about it is that they are acutely aware of is that if this thing wins, it's going to have ripple effects. It's going to have ripple effects in the company and probably with the broader workforce as well. And so they really don't want to see that happen.
So help me contextualize this a little bit more, because other Amazon warehouses outside of the US, in France, in Germany, they've been able to unionize. I don't remember seeing any items in the news about those, but it hasn't happened in the US. Why is it so hard to unionize in the US?
So I think we first need to start with the fact that the right to join a union is a federally protected legal right. That's something that people might not even know. It's in the UN Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And in Canada, it's actually written into the Charter, the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. But it is a federally protected legal right to form and join a union. The problem is that since that law was passed in 1935, it has eroded to the point where it almost is a dead letter. It's not completely a dead letter. Obviously, this campaign is happening. But for workers to be able to join a union in the U.S. today requires untold acts of heroism and bravery that shouldn't be required to exercise one's basic legal rights. So there's all these tremendous risks to one's livelihood and sometimes even personal safety that workers have to go through just to exercise their legal rights. The only example I can sort of make that's comparable, and even there it's not a perfect comparison, is the sort of restrictions on voting rights that we've seen through the years in the United States, and just the way that it creates these barriers to people exercising their fundamental rights.
So you have that context, and you have this very serious effort on part of Amazon to suppress this union, or at least attempt to fight its formation. There is a lot of energy around this Amazon unionization effort. A few people have likened it to what happened in GM, in General Motors, in the 1930s. What do you make of that analogy? Because that analogy means that, you know, if this particular domino falls, then a whole bunch of other places will feel more emboldened to unionize. Is that accurate?
I think that there are some similarities and differences, obviously. So it is similar in that Amazon is kind of the GM of the 21st century in the U.S. Mm. It's one of the leading companies. It has this global reach. It is one of the largest employers. And so at a symbolic level, it certainly works. And I think that there would be a demonstration effect because it's getting a lot of attention. I think that, and there's already a lot of other Amazon workers who have been contacting the RWDSU, the union involved in this, who are interested in starting campaigns in their workplaces. So at a symbolic level, I think that there's something to that. Where I think it's different is that the workers who struck the Flint plant in 1936 were very conscious that of the strategic node that they were occupying, basically. So the Fisher Body plant in Flint was a strategic plant. And when they shut that down, it literally shut down production across much of GM's assembly production network.
Right.
In a way that if you were to shut down the Bessemer warehouse, it would impact a lot of Amazon's delivery in that part of the South, but it wouldn't have these ripple effects throughout the entire distribution network the way that the Flint sit-down strike did.
I see.
So the structural power aspect is a bit different, but I think the symbolic power and the symbolic effect of a victory would be very similar.
Let's talk about Joe Biden and his role in all of this, because he has kind of openly vowed to be, in his words, the most pro-union president.
I made it clear when I was running that my administration's policy would be to support unions organizing and the right to collectively bargain. I'm keeping that promise.
What does that mean? Can he save unions in this case?
Well, he's not going to save unions, and the politicians in general aren't going to save unions, especially if you have the Senate filibuster in place. You know, I think that the only way that workers have gotten rights, or anyone has gotten rights in the United States, has been to fight for them. And so I think that the law that I was talking about, the 1935 law called the National Labor Relations Act or the Wagner Act, was one in the wake of this sort of massive worker upsurge. And then it sparked further worker upsurge. There's a give and take there. And I think we're going to have to see something like that to win back those rights that have been lost over the years. And Joe Biden's not going to give that to them. I think what I see Joe Biden as is somewhat of a political weather vane. And for a variety of reasons, not least of which is the fact that he had to run against Bernie Sanders and you had millions of people vote for a self-described democratic socialist who was championing things like workers' rights, you know, and you had the 2018 you know, red state revolt, the teacher strikes, and that workers' rights are much more on the agenda. And I think Biden knows that, and that he feels that he needs to be accountable to that constituency in a way that other previous presidents like Obama and others before him have not had to. So that's sort of a sign of the shifting political terrain in the United States. And I think Joe Biden reflects that. That being said, I mean, it is fairly unprecedented. I mean, you know, it's for a sitting U.S. president to issue that kind of full-throated endorsement of unions. And I think that's a positive thing that should be welcomed.
Yeah.
But it is indicative of how bad things are gotten that basically a president essentially stating the facts of the law is considered this monumental act,
yes,
this historic act. That's essentially what he said, is that, you know, there should be no employer interference and it is your right to join a union.
That's already the law.
That's the letter of the law, right? So, you know, you need some perspective here.
I'm interested in this analogy that you used of Joe Biden as a weather vane, because one thing that you mentioned is that teacher revolt across a bunch of red states in 2018. And that was huge. That was one of the larger labor uprisings I've seen in the last decade. And that's pretty significant. And then we enter into a global pandemic, a pandemic that has revealed that low-wage workers are the most at risk of being sick. They're the least protected. And I think the pandemic itself has kind of elevated the politicization of labor. Like, it's much easier, much closer to the surface to see how labor laws impact workers and put them in danger. And so I'm curious if we're going to see more come out of the pandemic, like more literacy of labor issues.
Well, it's a complex effect, right? So on the one hand, you're absolutely right that this whole discourse of essential workers, right? So these workers that were basically considered sort of unskilled disposable workers one day, the next day sort of become essential workers. The problem is that A, the essential worker rhetoric has remained more rhetoric than reality. And it, you know, a lot of the sort of steps that employers and governments took to actually recognize essential workers as actually important, you know, like pay bumps, unemployment benefits, adequate protective equipment. A lot of that stuff has fallen well short,
right,
of the promise, right, of the rhetoric. And the other part of it is that the collective action portion has really fallen off a cliff. So after the red state revolt of 2018, you had a spillover into 2019. There was that sort of spread and it sort of stayed at the highest level. And in 2020, the number of strikes in the U.S. just fell right off a cliff to next to nothing. So there really hasn't been a rebound in collective action. Now, I think what your remarks sort of hint at, and I think that there's something to it, that there is this increased literacy and this, at least this increased awareness that this is an important set of issues that we need to be caring about as a society.
Yes.
And that there is this solution, right, which is the union solution, right, which is an important thing for change to happen. Situation can get pretty bad and people can just sort of accept a bad situation unless they know that there's a choice, that they have an option that could actually improve things. And so, you know, it's possible. I mean, you know, movements develop in strange and unknowable ways sometimes, and they have these winding paths. And I think that what you could see here is sort of this next phase of the pandemic going into the post-pandemic era, where workers who have been sensitized to, you know, or not, I mean, they live this experience. It's not like they don't need to be sensitized to it, but sort of understand that there's this option, start actually more taking action, particularly if there's a win here with the Bessemer workers.
That unionization vote in that Bessemer Amazon warehouse, it closes the day that we are talking today. We will know the results in just a few weeks. Do you have a prediction as to what will happen?
I'm not into crystal balls. I'm okay. Obviously hopeful, but the fact is that, like I said, you know, like the lengths that workers have to go to exercise their basic legal right to join a union are such that you can never count the employer out, especially an employer as well-resourced and aggressive as Amazon.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Barry.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That was Barry Edlin, and when we get back, we talk to author and journalist Sarah Kendzior. We're just going to take a quick break. Back in a second. Hey, friends. I'm Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud. I'm the host of the new podcast, Commotion. If you don't know about us yet, well, we are your daily deep dive into the biggest stories coming out of the world of pop culture, art, and entertainment. And luckily, I'm not going to be doing it alone, okay? I'll be joined by some brilliant culture writers and thoughtful superfans. We're going to have hilarious hot takes. We're going to have vibrant debates. Consider this your invitation to join the group chat. Get in here and join us. Commotion, available weekdays on CBC Listen. Okay, we're back. So we started this special spin-off edition of Party Lines way back in September, and it was a moment when the whole world was tuning in to watch this election, the 2020 U.S. presidential election between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And we talked about what it would take to win the presidency. And then everything happened. The president got COVID. Ruth Bader Ginsburg died. There was a riot on Capitol Hill. This podcast was meant to last maybe just a few weeks to help listeners sort through the election, and then we kept going because the U.S., well, kept happening. And so to now slow down a little bit and help us look back and then look ahead, we've invited author and journalist Sarah Kendzior. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We started this podcast at the cusp of an election, and normally at the CBC, we wouldn't have a series dedicated to American politics, but that felt different. The election felt different. There was a lot of energy around it. People were seeking to understand so much. And a lot had to do with the man in charge for the past 4 years, Donald Trump. I don't think there's been a lot of time to process what has happened in those 4 years, let alone just the few months since the election. So I'm curious about where your thoughts are. Like, where are we in terms of processing?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And then, of course, you have to add to that the COVID pandemic,
yes,
you know, which altered our sense of time, our sense of security. And I think the world is traumatized, and Americans in particular are traumatized. And in that respect, it doesn't really matter who you voted for, if you voted for Biden or Trump. This feeling of trauma, I think, is the only collective feeling we have at the moment, because so much of our lives were violently uprooted in the last year, you know, whether through mass death or the collapse of our, or near collapse, I guess I should say, of our constitutional order.
Yes.
You know, that collapse, as I've mentioned before on the show, was long in coming. Institutions had been weakened for decades, and Trump was just a catalyst. But I don't think that we as a country have processed this. I think, like, after all traumas, there's this natural tendency to want to look away, to just sort of put things in the past. Like, we have the vaccine, Trump is out, you know, we're going to be okay. Unfortunately, I don't think that that's true, because I don't think that the flaws and the deep corruption that allowed all of this pain and trauma to happen in the first place have been remedied in any substantial way. So I expect this, unfortunately, to return within a couple years and probably manifest itself within the Biden administration as well.
You know, I have to say that just on the impulse of looking away, the story I've cared about most for the past 5 days has been the big boat that's stuck in the Suez Canal. And gosh, I try to read long-form journalism, and then my mind is like, let's get back to the boat. How are they doing with the boat? And I only bring this up because my colleague at BuzzFeed News, Catherine Miller, wrote this really excellent piece about how just a few years from now, it's going to be really hard to explain to someone how the world rose and fell on the whims of one person and one person's Twitter account. Like, we just occupied, so much of our brain space was occupied by Donald Trump. And he'd been known for this ability to withstand scandal and controversy and just, like, keep the story going at all times. Now we're sitting here a bunch of months after he lost the election, a couple of months after that Capitol Hill riot. Is there any chance that he's going to face any consequences for the legal troubles or for the voter fraud allegations or for that Capitol Hill riot? Anything at all?
I mean, I don't know what will happen. I know what should happen, which is that we need accountability, not only for Trump, but for his corrupt backers, for the mafia syndicates that have surrounded him throughout his entire 40-year career and which helped get him in office, for his complicity with hostile foreign actors. I mean, the list is very long, you know, and I detail this in my book, Hiding in Plain Sight. I detail his 40-year career of, well, you know, hiding in plain sight, of being a career criminal, an operative who's extremely savvy with media, extremely savvy now with digital media and social media, and is able to just commit brazen corruption by manipulating the law itself, you know, whether it through his army of lawyers, people like Roy Cohn, Michael Cohen, and then eventually Bill Barr, who was supposed to be, you know, the attorney general, but was really Trump's personal lawyer, to his sway over media and his, as president, his ability to abuse executive power to change law itself or to take pre-existing laws like the OLC memo, which said he couldn't be prosecuted, and use them to his advantage. And a lot of people were promising, a lot of Democrats were promising, that after Trump was out of office, there would be prosecutions of Trump. There would be prosecutions for things like the abuse of migrants on the border, the handling of the coronavirus, the shakedown of states in the, during the corona pandemic by people like Jared Kushner, Stephen Miller, and so on. There's been nothing. And I know it's been 2 months, and the priority of the Biden administration, rightfully, it was to get Americans vaccinated and to try to get our economy going again and, you know, all of these things. But they can do all of this at once. And the fact that they're putting aside investigations of coronavirus, of the Capitol riots, that the instigators of those riots have not been indicted, only the low-level people, only the people suckered in through Trump's Twitter account and so forth, have really been indicted. I don't know. I just know that as a country, for us to survive, there needs to be accountability and transparency for the crimes of Donald Trump. Because as I said before, if there is not, it will just rear its head again and again and again. And this doesn't just apply to Trump, but to any criminal actor that surrounded him.
I mean, I have to say that, like, we're sitting here in March and my brain is like, yeah, we really lived through that. Like, all of that really happened. And maybe it's because the past 2 months themselves, in terms of like the stories about COVID and the stories about the vaccines, have just been escalating in an entirely different direction than what we've lived through for the past 4 years. But is there any chance of Donald Trump fading away into obscurity? Like, is that what we're looking at, what we're experiencing right now?
I've been trying to figure out what he's been doing because it's very uncharacteristic of him to shun the spotlight or to not find a workaround. Like when he was banned from Twitter and from other social media platforms, I expected him to pop up on Fox News. And, you know, there are rumors he's starting his own digital media company. And that doesn't surprise me. This period reminds me of the early 1990s for him, after his bankruptcies, when he was really in danger of being indicted, like so many others were at that time, like Michael Milken, Ivan Boesky, other corrupt New York real estate and Wall Street guys. You know, they were basically rounded up. So what Trump did then is he just kind of lay low. He let other guys take the heat. And then he came back. You know, he had a comeback first by allowing Russian mafia actors and oligarchs to basically launder money through his properties, you know, and he needed that money very badly. And then he had an image makeover with The Apprentice. And so there's sort of like a 2-decade process of getting back to where he was. And, you know, he's an old man at this point. He's like 74. So I do think he'll reappear. I think he's going to be more of a symbol. I think he's going to be like a big martyr, a lost cause. You're already seeing this with the reaction to the election. I just drove from St. Louis all through Texas visiting family. And one thing I noticed is that there are still Trump signs all over, particularly rural areas of all of these states. And that's not something I've seen after an election. I mean, I kind of remember seeing it after the 2008 election with Obama, especially in majority black neighborhoods. I'd still see the signs after the election because it's a political statement. It's saying, you know, in the case of Obama, like, I am anti-racism. I am embracing this concept of a black president. I'm empowered by it. With Trump, it's the opposite. It's very similar to seeing Confederate flags. And you'd often see both. You know, when I would pass these houses, I'd see a Confederate flag and a Trump flag because he's the new lost cause. And so I think he'll continue in that vein. But I think that younger people, younger Republicans, are going to pick up that mantle, some of whom are related to him. I think Ivanka and Don Jr. in particular are going to be active with Kushner behind the scenes, but also younger senators like the one from my state, Josh Hawley, people like Ted Cruz, the senators and representatives who encouraged the seditious attack on the Capitol on January 6th, they are very likely to pick up Trump's mantle and they'll always be in his shadow. And I would think that would be very humiliating for them. Mm-hmm. To live in the shadow of a career criminal game show host. But, you know, they don't seem to mind because the money keeps on flowing and the threats flow if they don't go with, you know, what that particular group of actors wants them to do.
I think at the same time, you have an interesting dynamic emerging in the fact that this past election had the highest voter turnout in 100 years. And certainly voting is not the only way to be politically engaged, but it is fair to say that Americans have become more engaged in politics. But it is taken on a very partisan sort of flavor, very partisan basis. It seems like there's deeper levels of polarization that people are working with right now. And I guess I have to ask, do you think these two sides will ever meet again? Is there hope for an idea of reaching across the aisle, of persuading someone to take a different position? Or is this the politics of now and going on forward?
I think what we have now is tyranny of the minority on a state level. And I say this as a resident of a state that really has this issue. In Missouri, for example, citizens have voted for very progressive ballot initiatives over and over, getting rid of dark money in politics, raising the minimum wage, and so forth. And overwhelmingly, the citizens of this state do this, including the Republicans. And then our legislature simply strikes them down. They don't adhere to the will of the people. The same thing is happening in Georgia. And they're also striking down the right to vote or the right to vote freely and to not be disenfranchised. It's happening in Michigan. And so that is the strategy at the moment of the Republican Party, is to contain this overwhelming majority that does want democracy, that does want a free country. We may not all agree on everything, but we do agree on that. And the Republican Party, their leadership is very savvy. That's why they're poking at voting rights right now. That's why they're being so aggressive, is because they saw what happened in Georgia with the election in 2020 in particular, that Georgia has two Democratic senators and voted for Joe Biden. That's a horror story for them. And this is why the Democrats need to use their full power while they have it, while they have control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, because that will not happen again unless they fix the voting rights issue. And so, yeah, I think it is absolutely possible to reach across the aisle to, say, conservatives who still value our country's cohesion, its future. You know, we may not agree on everything. That's normal. That's part of living in a democracy. I don't think it's possible to reach across the aisle to aspiring autocrats, career criminals, people who are either issuing threats or being threatened into obedience. It is absolutely impossible to work with people like that. You know, that is a mafia state. You cannot negotiate with a mafia state. You cannot befriend them and, you know, say it's all going to work out. You have to fight them. I hope these battles are fought in court instead of on the streets, but I could easily see it turning to that. I could see it turning to even more violence than the U.S. already has.
So when you're confronted with a moment like the pandemic, like this political moment, it feels like a moment of transition. And to put a positive spin on that, I guess it could be a moment of transformation. All of which is to say that these past 4 years for America have felt like an inflection point of saying you're going to choose one direction or the other. What is next for America? Are these last 4 years going to be sort of a blip in history, a footnote in history, or is this what America has to worry about next?
I think that these last 4 years were the culmination and acceleration of very bad trends in our history. You know, both things that go back to the founding of the U.S., you know, with the genocide of Native Americans, with slavery, but especially trends since the 1970s, continual acts of corruption, whether Watergate, Iran-Contra, the illegal war in Iraq, the financial crisis, for which nobody paid the price. And see, that's the thing. People have a choice. Everyone has a choice here. They have a choice in how they treat others. They have a choice in how active they want to be in our political system. And those with power have the choice of whether or not they are going to finally hold these criminal actors accountable. Because the thing is, if many of these actors had been held accountable the first several times around, people like Roger Stone that pop up in basically all of the things I just mentioned, we wouldn't have these problems. You know, these are architects of American ruin, and they absolutely need to be stopped. And it also needs to be spelled out to the American public just how dangerous this is. This is where both Congress and the media did a grave disservice. I think that they were frightened to some degree. So they continually played down what was happening. They didn't want to scare off their audience. They didn't want to come off as hysterical or hyperbolic or whatever. They were very concerned about their own reputations instead of the safety and security of this country and the freedom of this country. And so that's the choice to make now. And this is a good time to make that choice because we do have Biden in as president. We have Trump Trump gone. The sort of structural power is in the favor of those who seek to protect democracy. So I hope people make the right choice, but that's what it comes down to. It's not magic. It's not inevitable. It's not from above. It's from below. And so I hope Americans have learned the right lessons from the last 4 years, and they put pressure on those who hold positions of power, their representatives and so forth, to hold bad actors accountable. And I hope those representatives do that.
What did we learn, do you think, about the fundamentals of American institutions, all public institutions, really, governments, the courts? What did we learn about them in the last 4 years, about their health, about how sturdy they are?
I mean, I think it depends on what place you started. For me, this was a lot of confirmation of things I'd been saying for years that a lot of folks didn't want to believe, because they believed in American exceptionalism. They believed that we would always be a democracy. They believed that our national security apparatus actually cared about the country's survival, which is something that I question. One thing I've noticed is that as I would explain what was happening with the Trump administration and with the precedents to it, you know, this deep corruption within the government and with corporate actors and other accomplices, I'd get a very different reaction from, say, Black Americans or most Black Americans than from white Americans. Because if I said the government doesn't keep its word, laws don't protect everyone equally, and so forth, I never had any Black American question that, because they've lived that and their ancestors have lived that. You know, they lived that broken, bifurcated reality. I think for some white folks, especially white Democrats and liberals and so on, it was a bit of a wake-up call how unstable and deeply broken our system was. I think under the Obama administration, a lot of people didn't want to admit that. They were starting to admit it more when it came to things like the economy, incredible income equality, incredible consolidation of wealth by a very, very narrow elite, and that elite kept growing more narrow under Trump. My worry is that people will forget the lessons that they learned. And again, I think that's somewhat understandable because of the additional trauma of COVID. I think a lot of folks just want to forget 2020, period. They just want to put that year out of their mind. And the same thing happened at the end of the Spanish flu, which of course came right after World War I. And you had a similar situation with people being very, very traumatized and wanting to forget the lessons of that time. But then look at what happened back then in the late 19-teens and 1920s. And then of course, in the 1930s, you see mass white mob violence in places like Tulsa, East St. Louis, you know, incredible persecution of Black Americans and immigrant American communities. You saw the buildup to World War II, and you saw a refusal to try to control the economic despair and political despair that led to the rise of Hitler and Stalin and so many, and Mussolini and so many other dictators at that time, and even sort of burgeoning fascist movement in the U.S. in the 1930s that we're lucky was stamped out. I'm not sure we're going to be so lucky this time around. So we need to look at the lessons of recent history and more distant history and fully be realistic and honest about what we're capable of as Americans, because we're not exceptional in this way.
Sarah Kendzior, I have to say, anxiously, trepidatiously, perhaps sometimes, even when we don't want to, we across the rest of the world will be, of course, watching closely. Thank you so much for your insights and your help.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Our guests today were Barry Edelin, a professor at McGill University who looks at U.S. labor relations, and journalist and author Sarah Kendzior. That is it for this week, and also that is it for the season. Thank you so much for listening to Party in the USA. We would love to know what you thought. Please share with us your thoughts about the podcast on Twitter at CBC Podcasts, or email us at podcasts@cbc.ca. I've been your host, Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud. Do not worry, the regular version of Party Lines with Rosemary Barton is not going anywhere. I will see you on Thursday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.